KALW.
It's forcing us to make decisions that we didn't have to make before.
San Francisco officials have reduced the jail population by 25% because of the coronavirus.
The jail medical director has told us we have to do so in order to save lives.
District Attorney Chesa Boudin on how the pandemic is forcing change in the criminal justice system. Then we meet an Oakland barber who's dealing with the closure of his shop.
If I were, you know, poaching or a vulture type tactic, hell yeah, I'm open. Come on down at any time. What am I showing the client? Am I showing that I really value them as a person? Because I could be spreading that virus. What if I have it?
And we'll hear how a modern boogie funk group represents the Bay Area's diversity.
You know, the Pendletons, when we're up on stage, we have a lot of different faces up there and a lot of different people that kind of represent everybody.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin has often described walking through steel gates to visit his parents in prison as a kid. Now a corrections officer who works in the New York State prison where his father is in custody has tested positive for COVID-19. Like a lot of family members of people incarcerated, he's worried about being left in the dark as the virus spreads. As a prosecutor, he's also working to reduce the risks of an outbreak in San Francisco's jails. He's instructed staff to examine cases to see who can be released early. KALW Justice reporter Holly J. McDeed spoke with him over the phone.
My father is 75 years old. He recently had surgery. He's in a prison in New York State that doesn't actually have a single doctor on staff. And he lives in very close quarters with other inmates, as is true in jails and prisons across the country. I did speak with him last weekend. His health was at that time good. His spirits were good. He was concerned about continuing to make phone calls because they, of course, share a phone with many hundreds of other inmates, and everybody's speaking into the same mouthpiece. They have very limited sanitation materials and hygiene materials, and he was anticipating that his entire prison would be put on lockdown, meaning virtually no movement. Of course, getting food, getting access to food, knowing how that food had been prepared by who is going to be a constant challenge in this period for him and for other people locked up across the country. Given my father's age, given his medical issues and the lack of medical resources available at his prison, I'm absolutely worried for his well-being, for his risk of exposure, and for what would happen if he contracts COVID-19.
And what are some of your biggest worries about what could happen if there were a major outbreak in San Francisco's jails?
We received a letter from the director of jail health, who works for the Department of Public Health here in San Francisco. The way the letter put it is that, and I'm quoting here, an outbreak in the San Francisco County Jail could result in catastrophic outcomes for those staff and incarcerated persons in high-risk groups. And the letter goes on to explain that, you know, people are coming in and out of jail 24/7, and any one person in that population who gets it would likely then spread like wildfire to the rest of the inmates and staff because of the close proximity and the impossibility in the jail setting of social distancing or good hygiene. The jail medical director urged me and other criminal justice department heads and officials to quickly reduce the jail population. As she says, a rapid reduction in the jail population will provide an opportunity to create distance between people in cells and mitigate the spread of infection. That's a very serious challenge. It's a serious mandate for us. And what I'm trying to do to the extent possible, both with regard to the jail population as well as with regard to practices in my own office and amongst my staff, is what I wish the President of the United States were doing, which is I'm trying to let the medical professionals take the lead in the midst of this medical crisis. If we go back to the date that the state of emergency was declared, the jail population was, on March 4th, was 1,097. Just in about 3 weeks, we've taken it from 1,097 down to 899. We've done that because the jail medical director has told us we have to do so in order to save lives.
Are there any public safety concerns about getting the jail population down to that level and having to release more inmates in order to do so?
Right now, the single leading risk to public safety is COVID-19 across the country. That is the single biggest fear in terms of likely loss of life that people around the country have. It doesn't mean that we don't have other concerns, that, you know, violence and guns and so on don't continue to be a concern. But right now, to keep us safe, what we need to do is find ways to limit the spread of COVID-19 and make sure the jail doesn't become a vector and a repository for the disease. You know, with individuals who are being released, many of them are people who themselves are gravely, gravely ill. Earlier today, I was working on a woman who is 33 years old, who's pregnant, who's charged with a misdemeanor, who's already pled guilty to that misdemeanor, and has something like 2 more months of jail time to serve before her sentence is up. Now, it's a misdemeanor. It's a nonviolent misdemeanor. It involves property. The notion that public safety, particularly in the context of COVID-19 epidemic, that public safety is somehow furthered by keeping a pregnant woman in jail is just simply inconsistent with any notion of public safety that I'm familiar with or could adopt.
Are there positive changes you've seen come from this health crisis that you'd like to see continue in San Francisco's criminal justice system?
I think the crisis is forcing all of us in the criminal justice system to be much more efficient, much more streamlined, and much more focused on the cases that are the most serious. We simply don't have the capacity in this moment, with courtrooms shutting down, with members of various law enforcement agencies getting sick, with lawyers working from home, et cetera, to prosecute all the cases that we were used to prosecuting, to hold all the people in jail that we were used to holding in jail. And so it's forcing us to make decisions that we didn't have to make before. I ran for district attorney in part because of a belief that we could and should significantly reduce the number of people we prosecute, the number of people we put in jail. I ran on a commitment to reduce the jail population in San Francisco by enough to close County Jail Number 4. And we are now well below the number of people needed to close County Jail 4. If we can sustain the current jail population, or even sustain it within a plus 10 or 15% range, we can safely close County Jail 4 and not need it again even after this crisis passes. So I think it's teaching us some lessons about how we can hold people accountable, protect the public, enforce the laws in ways that don't rely so narrowly and so heavily on incarceration as a primary response.
That was San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin speaking with KLW's justice reporter Holly J. McDeed. Alice Wolfley helped produce that interview. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. One sector that's been hit hard by the novel coronavirus closures is the grooming industry, the nail shops, the hair salons, and the barbershops. The government does not consider them essential services. These small businesses are having to let workers go. Others have switched to doing house calls. Customers have been calling on people to support their stylists and barbers by paying them for future service. And some are stubbornly still open despite the orders to close. Damian Hunter owns Mega Brown's Barbershop in Oakland. He has shut down. I called him up to see how all this has affected him and his customers. So, Damian, how's it going?
It's a quite peculiar time, I should say. With all of the closures of small businesses, people having to distinguish between if their career choice is an essential one or not. Driving through the city, going to neighborhood restaurants and seeing that they're all closed. In downtown Oakland, a lot of businesses are boarded up in fear of looting and retaliation to businesses being closed. I am also facing the, you know, the dilemma. You know, I have to let my other barber know that the doors will be closed temporarily. I give God praise for the fact that he took it well, because other people wouldn't at this time, you know, and it's kind of sad thinking about that. But I mean, that's the state that we're in now.
So, Damon, what about your customers? What are you hearing from them?
Well, many of the customers are complaining about the afros that they have or the long hair that they have. And many of them want me to either open the shop up, you know, in secret, almost like a speakeasy style, so that they can get a haircut in private. Many of them are dang near forcing me to open my door, saying that, you know, that their haircut is a necessity and that I should be open. I even have clients who are elder, who I call seasoned clients. I have to turn those away, you know, and many of them, you know, are weekly clients that come in every Saturday, and I have to tell them, hey, you know, your health is a lot more important than the haircut at this time. You know, we will be able to reconvene and have a great time at the shop. But until then, you know, drastic measures must happen. Leading up to the closure, I've been wearing gloves for the past 4 or 5 months, but I had to extend things, you know, to make sure that everything is properly sanitized and to overkill measures where I have to wipe down the seats and wipe down all metal parts and make sure that I'm using a mask when I cut hair. And that became more of an inconvenience for me, just to make sure I'm doing my part to not spread the virus, which is creating a great fear and panic within myself, you know, me not wanting to contribute to the widespread pandemic that we're in.
The barbershop is about much more than hair, as, you know, you and I have met at your shop. You even have a little library. It's about literacy. It's about connection. It's about a place of community.
Yeah, the barbershop experience is definitely one of a kind. And it transcends all race, age, and creed. I do my best to make sure that everyone who walks in, you know, not only enjoys a great haircut, but it is about the experience, you know, being able to talk to your barber, your therapist, your counselor, your fellow parent, someone who's in the trenches or right alongside of you, making sure that, you know, the task gets done on a daily basis. We are the best entertainers in my eye, you know, and it's a constant revolving door. So it's the amount of people, the amount of hairstyles, the amount of personalities that we have to manage and memorize and juggle just to provide an experience is definitely one of a kind.
I called up some salons and some barbershops and they were like, we are open. What do you think about that?
I think the businesses that are open and ones that are publicizing that they're open whenever people call, it's a bad move. There are two different types of barbers in my profession. There are quality barbers and quantity barbers. Quality barbers are all about the experience in the chair. They're all about, you know, the lasting impression, you know. And then there's a quantity barber where those who are all about the numbers, where they just want to just keep jamming heads in there, you know, because they want to get a profit. I understand that. They're both sides to the business, like two sides of the coin. Me personally, I care about the quality that I'm putting out there. I care about the fact that I shouldn't have to duck and dodge and cut the blinds down whenever I see someone new walk by, because I shouldn't be open, you know. And businesses are getting fined. I've heard of barbershops and salon owners who got fined, you know, $482, which is a hefty price tag when you have very little money coming in because your business is shut down 80% because of the virus. I personally have had people call and I have to tell them, hey, man, I'm closed. And I've got nothing but respect because of that. Now, if I were, you know, poaching or a vulture type tactic, and hell yeah, I'm open. Come on down at any time. What am I showing the client? am I showing that I really value them as a person? Because I could be spreading the virus. What if I have it? And most people don't even know that. Unbeknownst to them, they may be walking around with it. And then you're contaminating other people. You know, you're getting other people sick for the sake of your own pockets. It's a bit immoral. But I can't point fingers because there are salon owners. I've seen plenty. I walk down the street and there are hours, you know, posts that they're open and there are lights on in there. And I can't do it personally.
What can people do to support the businesses like yours, the barbershops and the salons?
That's a great question. And I believe that the best thing that you can do at this moment is to get on Google+, to get on Yelp, all of these different review sites, and post a great review about the place that you frequent. You know, because once this shelter in place is over, you know, people are going back to their everyday life, and more people will be looking for those services, those haircuts, those massages, those braiders. Flood the review sites for these businesses, like myself and Mega Browns. Just flood these sites and let people know how you feel about the service and the business and the people and the ambiance in that establishment, and so that business can increase exponentially once this shelter in place is over. I think that is the best move to do.
Damian Hunter owns Mega Browns, a barbershop in Oakland. You can hear more about how the novel coronavirus is affecting Black communities in the latest edition of The Stoop podcast, hosted by me and Leela Day. Find it on your podcast player or at thestoop.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And we're going to end today's show with some music to get down to. San Francisco group The Pendletons are a boogie funk and modern soul project made up of E Da Boss and Trailer Limon. These two producers joined forces 8 years ago, and they've been keeping the 80s boogie sound alive ever since. They even released their music on cassette and vinyl. In this edition of Bay Area Beats from our archives, The Pendletons share with us their musical influences, including San Francisco's funk DJ scene.
We had been struggling to figure out what we were going to call ourselves. We didn't know. And I walked into Crossroads and there was a Pendleton shirt. And I remember walking out of the store in Upper Haight going, the Pendletons. And at that moment, I texted Dan and I was like, the Pendletons. And he was like, yeah, that's it. Hey, my name's Eric, a.k.a. DJ E, the boss of the Pendletons.
My name is Dan, a.k.a. Trailer Limon, with the Pendletons. I guess modern funk really is the blanket sort of term for this kind of music.
What's different than what we do from a lot of other people that do this music is we have a heavy hip hop influence in it. And in the Funk Forever EP, you can see like a lot more influences from jazz. You know, we got a lot more horns involved this time.
We got this live interaction. We had a live drummer, bassist, keyboard player, and they kind of were, you know, able to sort of play off each other. Eric has like a crazy collection of obscure music. He'll bring a lot of times cuts as an inspiration, you know what I mean?
Yeah, a couple of the songs that I used were Ozone, Our Hearts Will Always Shine, and Lionel Richie, Love Will Find a Way. I would just take a four-bar loop and then ask them to give us a different take on that.
And then we built the song through that and added a bunch of layers and wrote our lyrics. I keep living, just won't give it, there's no guarantee. We keep racing, but we're facing so much tragedy. When we first started out, we were doing a little bit more beat culture oriented stuff too. That was actually, I mean, it was cool stuff, but it kind of didn't pan out to the point that we wanted to put it on a record necessarily. So then we made the record, our first record, which was Waiting On You Coming Down, and it really kind of hit, like a lot of people really liked it. So we started to kind of lean more in that boogie direction.
There was a huge resurgence of this music because it was the DJs that were playing it in the clubs to the masses. So Sweater Funk, it's a party in San Francisco that happens every week on a Sunday night in the Mission District at the Knockout. I had the test presses and I just walked down to Sweater Funk one night and I was like, you know, if you like it, play it. I mean, that moment changed everything for us because that record from that point immediately took off.
It was just a cool combo, man. They really created a really good springboard atmosphere for our music.
That party, they really, really honed in on the really underground side of that music. All the music that I grew up listening to, riding around in my mom's car when I was like 10 years old in Newark, New Jersey, like listening to the radio.
So I grew up in the Bay Area and my dad was super into Tower Power. So we played that a lot in my youth. Bump City in particular. I remember hearing that a lot when we were on road trips because we had it on a cassette tape. You got to so we just always bump this album and it was just so lively. Not only did they have just amazing music, but there was also that diversity of the Bay Area. And I was like, oh, there's a white guy in the band. There's a Latino dude in the band. There's African-American influence too. It just felt like we can all party together. You know, the Pendletons, when we're up on stage, we have a lot of different faces up there and a lot of different people that kind of represent everybody. If people want to see that, to me, that's kind of what funk is about. You know, funk is about that inclusivity, that diversity, and just being able to go to a party and really lose yourself.
For me, I want people to listen to it anytime, as long as they're having a good time.
That edition of Bay Area Beats was produced by Marisol Medina Cadena. The Pendletons just released their latest EP called Don't Turn Your Back earlier this month. And while we can't go to shows right now, you can check it out online. We've got a link to it at kalw.org. And while you're there, make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents podcast. Today's team includes Janae Darden, Precious Green, Lisa Morehouse, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Sarah Lai Sterling. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.